Om Hari Om. There's an ashram in India, and the name of the ashram is Anandashram. And it's in the south in Kerala state, in a little village called Hanagad. And it's not very famous with Westerners and tourists. And this ashram has been there about 50 years only. And in this ashram, there were two teachers, a man and a woman. The man's name was Swami Ramdas, Papa Ramdas, not Baba Ramdas from America, Swami Ramdas from India. And the woman was Mother Krishna Bai. And I'll tell you a story, since we're supposedly talking about death and dying, about this ashram and about the death of Mother Krishna Bai. Who's been to that ashram? Anybody? Yes. Well, you look like Papa. You have that same look. You're welcome, yeah. Any place else you tell a woman that she looks like a man, it's not always the best thing, but Papa, that's okay. How many people know who Sam Lewis was? Sam Lewis, Murshid Sam, oh, a lot of people. He was the spiritual teacher from San Francisco. That's how he would introduce himself. He would say, Samuel Lewis, San Francisco. Sometimes he would say, Samuel Lewis, spiritual teacher from San Francisco. And he was a visionary, Murshid Sam, and he was the vision of the Sufi dancing, of the dances of universal peace. And he would get him in vision. They would just come to him while he slept. I saw it happen. Woke up in the morning all excited. He got an angel dance in the night. And he was just all excited. Anyway, Murshid Sam was just a very realized human being. Very rare. He suffered a lot in this life. And he was a disciple of Inayat Khan, Hazrat Inayat Khan, who was Pirzia's grandfather and Pir Vilayat's father. And Murshid Sam was a young man and encountered Inayat Khan. And he was his student. And Inayat Khan gave him a very powerful spiritual transmission. And because of that very powerful transmission, Murshid Sam was rejected by a lot of spiritual groups for most of the rest of his life. And it deepened his heart greatly, heightened his realization, and enabled him to connect with some incredibly beautiful people and be rejected by some incredibly not so beautiful people. Murshid Sam also was a little unusual. He said what he thought. In this world, you just don't do that. It wasn't that he didn't filter things. He filtered everything and he said what he thought. But it wasn't what he thought. As he said, most people on the spiritual path have this wonderful phone connection with God. And he said, they can pick up the phone and talk to God whenever they wish. He said, the only difference is my phone works both ways. And it did. It definitely did. He gave me my name, Shahabuddin, and it was a little unusual. We'll get back to Anandashram in a second, and if we go through the whole story, maybe we never have to touch death and dying. I came home to my house one day. He was staying with me, and he was all excited. He was jumping up and down like this. And he said, come inside. And I went inside, and he opened a book, and he said, you see that? I said, what? He said, that name. The name was Shahabuddin. I said, yes. He said, that's your name. It came to me straight from God. And I had to turn to him and say, but Murshid, I already have a name. He looked at me. He said, you do? I said, yeah, Pir Vilayat gave me a name, which I never liked and never used once. And he said, okay, make a choice. I said, okay. I'll pick this name. He said, good. Now go tell Pir Vilayat. So it just so happened that Murshid Sam and Pir Vilayat had just had a meeting. The first wonderful meeting happened in my house. Not the first time they met, but the first real connect. They had this great connection in New York. So I then went to Pir Vilayat. And I was the doorkeeper for Pir Vilayat during, people used to come for interviews, maybe 5 or 6 people a day, and Pir Vilayat would give the interviews, and I would always keep time and say, okay, time's up. And I was always the last interview, and my interview was great because he was always exhausted and would sleep through my whole interview. And so I could tell him anything. You know, he would be on the couch snoring, and I would just go on as if he was wide awake, and I felt totally at home. That's why, as I said yesterday, I don't care if people sleep in my seminars. It doesn't bother me at all. So I'm talking to Pir Vilayat, who's sleeping, and I say, and by the way, Murshid Sam gave me a name, and I'm going to use that name. And all of a sudden, Pir Vilayat goes, well, what name? So I told him, I said, well, he gave me this name, Shahabuddin, and I said, and you gave me a name, too. He said, I did? What name did I give you? So I told him, and he said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to use Shahabuddin. He said, oh, that's a much better name than the one I gave you anyway. So, now, there's always someone. I know my friend Shibley asked me the other day, what name did Pir Vilayat give you? But I don't tell you, so don't ask, because it's disrespectful. It's one of the names of God. How could I not like it? But I didn't. So far, God has held no grudges, as far as I can tell. Murshid Sam was in a conversation with some people, men and women, young men and women at the time. We were in our 20s, early 20s, and they were complaining because there weren't enough women on the spiritual path. And instead of giving a rational answer, which anybody else would have done, Murshid Sam calmly turned to everybody and said, oh, yeah? Well, the highest person on the planet's a woman. What do you think of that? And of course, nobody could say anything because he had such presence when he used to say these things that you knew it was true. There was no space for arguments and disagreement. So somebody, fortunately, said, Murshid, who is that? And he said, oh, well, it's Mother Krishnabai, of course. So, and she was the most down-to-earth human being you would ever meet. Unbelievable. And yet, now I'll get to the story about her death. I was going with, some of you know, I still take groups of people traveling to unusual places in the world. I like doing that. So there were about 35 of us, and we were going to Anandashram. And I knew that Mataji was sick. And I told everybody, you need to know before you come on the trip that we went to Delhi and other places, but it's very possible we might get there and she might not be alive. So you need to know this. And even if she's alive, really we can't visit her now anyway because she's in the process of leaving. But everybody wanted to go anyway, and everybody's very excited. Oh, we're going to go see her and so on. And we get to a town about 2 hours away, and I just knew she had died. And I turned to Katharineta and I said, she's not alive. She just died. She's not alive anymore. And we get to the ashram, and it was interesting because Katharineta said, well, tell everybody. And I said, well, I don't have enough confidence yet in my spiritual awareness to just make pronouncements on things that I get from the ethers. Now, it doesn't bother me at all. The worst that happens is it's not so. But then I held it in, and we got there, and of course, she had just died a few hours ago. And the ashram was filled with these sadhus, holy men and women from all over India. And I don't know if you know who or what the sadhus are. They're the real ones. They live in places out of the way, and they live sometimes in a jungle. They've never have a roof over their head. They don't travel in vehicles. They don't sign their name. They don't go in cars. They don't go in trains. And the place is full of these sadhus. And so I was talking to one. Many speak English. But I was talking to one, a little old man who wanted to take my youngest son Varan was with us at the time, and he wanted me to give him Varan. He said, just for 6 years, and I'll return him to you, and you won't, you know, no problem. And So we were talking, and I asked him where he lived, and he told me, and I knew where it was. It's way up in the Himalayas. And I said, why are you in the south? He said, oh, I came to see Mataji's passing. And I said, yeah, but you're 1,000 miles from here. How did you get here? He said, I walked. And I said, well, when did you leave there? He said, oh, about 3 or 4 months ago. I don't know, something like that. And he said, but I wanted to be here for the day. And I said, so you knew? He said, oh, we all knew. And the place was just full. But that even that's not the story. You might think it is, but as soon as she died, they took the body and they burned the body. This is traditional in Hinduism. You wash the body, then you cover it with butter, and you put the body on a platform of sandalwood. They don't use sandalwood much anymore because it's very expensive. And the body burns. You immediately, you say the prayers and you burn the body. When it is certain people, holy people, they make, it looks like a low fence about that high of bricks. They just pile the bricks in a rectangle, but they leave spaces between the bricks so the air can get in. And they burn the body in that, and they cover it with granite slabs, these big slabs of granite. And they let it burn like that for 12 hours. And then they take off the granite, the air comes in, the flames rush up again, and that's the second step of the burning. Well, when we got to the ashram, there's a Swami who was the successor of Mother Krishnabai. He's still there. He's an old man, Swami Satchidananda. Not the Satchidananda who died recently in the West, but IYI Satchidananda. But incredibly beautiful human being, Swami Satchidananda. Anyway, he came to me, and he had the same smile on his face that he always has, and she had just died. And Papaji and Mother Krishnabai had taken him when he was 12. He was an orphan, and they got him. And here, it was like his mother was dying, has just died, same smile, that ineffable smile that he wears. And he said, oh, now Shahabuddin, he greeted all of us. And he said, now you'll stay in this room. And there were a lot of people in the ashram, but he had a room for all of us. And it was mattresses, which was nice. I mean, there were 35 of us. And I was very thankful because there were just hundreds of sadhus and guests, and everybody was there. And he said, but the most important thing is at 5 o'clock this afternoon, we're going to take the slabs of granite off. And you must be there then. That's the time of greatest blessing. I said, of course, and I collected the group, and I said to everybody, now listen, at 5 o'clock today, there is this special ceremony, and you must be there. And everybody was so excited because it was an event filled with blessing. And the people on the trip, some of them were Murids for 25 years, and really lovers of the path, and lovers of God, whatever way, shape, or form. At about 4:45, I went into this room we were all staying in. People were sleeping and so on, and I woke everybody up and said, "Now this ceremony is going to start." "Oh, okay, great. We'll all be there." And Catherineta, of course, and I had our two youngest kids, Varan and Veena, and we took them and we went to the ceremony. Out of the 35 people, I think 4 people woke up. Everybody else either slept or, "Oh, I got sick, I had to go for a walk." Just the strangest thing. Now, why do I tell this story? Because when the blessing comes, even in this way, if it's just this information about death, when the blessing comes, there are many who find reasons not to take it. And some of you know the prayer we say, Rasul. And the first line is warner, warner of coming dangers. The coming dangers are not apocalypse. The coming dangers, that's about our falling asleep at the moments when we're asked to be awake. So when we're asked to be awake, the moment when we need to be awake, what happened, by the way, is I was carrying either one or both of my kids, I don't remember, because they were little then. And there were 1,500 people there at least. And because I was carrying the kids, and Varan had white blonde hair, so in India this was quite unusual, and Veena was this beautiful little cherub, and so everybody made room for us, and they kind of separated, and we were standing right next to where the body was burning. It just happened. I didn't think, "Oh, I want to be up front." It was like the Red Sea, you know, it parted, and we went up there. Just as we got there, Swamiji said some prayers, and at a certain signal, some people stepped forward and simultaneously picked up the 3 pieces of granite, 4 people per slab. The wind immediately came in and started whoosh. All of the ashes, which were still alive with fire, all of the ashes were blown out of the pyre. And not only were we all covered up front with this incredible blessing of the ashes, but because the sun was setting, it was later in the day, you could see through the dust of the ashes that we were breathing in and out. The ashes, you cannot get any more direct blessing, you know? And I see that as one of the great moments of my life that had great effect. So people often say to me, "Well, how did you learn so much about death?" Because I do a lot of work, especially with hospice workers and doctors and nurses, a lot on death and dying, because I find they're very afraid. And it's very important that they create a certain atmosphere so when someone dies, they're not leaving in a confused atmosphere. So I say, "Well, I've ingested a lot of it. I've just absorbed it. And it's been a blessing. And I'm happy to share it, but stay awake." So. Yes. It is important. We'll go over that. There are some traditions where you wait 3 days. And there are others where you burn the body immediately or bury the body immediately. So I have a suggestion. Can we all move the chairs in? You seem very far away. You know the old Nasruddin joke about the ones who know tell the ones who don't know? We'll do the best we can. I can't recap all of yesterday, but it is important to know the following, that upon death, we do give back in each succeeding level of consciousness that which is of that level of consciousness. So we leave the body here, the physical body. You know, you can freeze your body or do whatever you want with it. Waste of money, folks. I don't know if I gave them yesterday, and there are thousands, but there are only two major groupings that you do need to know. The first is levels of consciousness that have to do with the mind. Now, for Sufis, when they talk about the mind, they talk about something very vast and the four parts of that vastness, and they call that the five parts of mind. The vastness itself is the heart. And then there are four levels, which are not really levels. There are four ways of the mind. One of them is thinking and feeling. One of them is memory. One of them is ego. One of them is willpower. Those are the four expressions of mind. So after physical death, the mind, in each of those parts, leaves in more and more subtle levels of mind those impressions that it has taken from it, that it has covered itself with. And the next level is the angelic, or worlds of light, worlds of glory. Now, there are many levels of each of those, and I just can't, in the time allotted, go into that. But the necessary information is that the mind worlds go from densest to finest. The densest being what we call the astral and the shadow worlds, into incredibly beautiful worlds. And they're so beautiful and so etheric and so perfect that many people, in realizing those worlds, which are still of the mind in that they still have form, have called those worlds God or heaven. And they're right in doing so. I mean, people can call anything that they experience anything that they need it to be. And for many of us, if we saw those worlds with their perfection and their harmony and their beauty, we would say, well, this must be heaven, because there can't be anything more perfect than this. And that those worlds are the height of the worlds of form. There are worlds where flowers are designed, you know, where the intelligence, out of the intelligence comes the form of flowers, for example. You can imagine those are worlds of great beauty. But those are still levels of mind. Now, not mind, just thinking. Remember, thinking is just one aspect. Those are levels of the heart and expressions of the heart. Then we get into more abstract worlds, worlds of pure light, pure sound. And that's what we allude to as the angelic. And I said yesterday, the angelic is not about, you know, little beings with wings that you put on your lapel and buy a pin or something, but vast, vast, really galactic vibrations. Time that's of a scale that we cannot possibly relate to. And yet, the most important thing is that each of these levels of consciousness is part of us right now. The only shift that occurs is right now. Our consciousness is drawn to that which is most magnetic and most dense, and that's the physical world. Obviously, the dream world, for example, is less dense. It's not physical. And so when the body takes its rest, so to speak, when it loses its magnetism to pull the consciousness, then the consciousness goes to the next level of density. And we have our dreams. Now you might say, but I don't have nightmares. I don't dream about shadow worlds and so on. Right. That's your consciousness is just not drawn there. So it kind of lifts right through that. On the other hand, there are some people who said, come to me and say, I must have a terrible consciousness. I dream terrible dreams. And usually they're very angelic people. And it's not that they have a terrible consciousness. It's that there are many beings suffering in those worlds. And there are many sympathetic people whose consciousness is drawn wherever they're suffering. And so they have just difficult dream experiences, nightmares, because they cannot resist the need and the hope to go where people are suffering. And they do help, by the way. It's not wasted, you know. So this is just my opinion, but we human beings judge ourselves very harshly, very, very harshly. In so doing, we judge God very harshly too. God who is, all these Sufis this weekend, you know, were talking about love and God is the lover. And if I could really probe into the depth of many of your hearts, you would see God is a jailer. You know, God is the one who runs the prison. Now, we don't like to admit it, but that part is there. And that heritage, which not we, but we as a civilization have passed on to our children is a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. And our generation and the one to follow are the ones who are going to correct this finally. You know, it wasn't always this way. And humanity evolves, and as you know, Sufism evolves. And there was a time when human civilization was almost barbaric. And so it needed very strict boundaries so that it would stop some of these practices, which were so horrendous. I mean, in at the time before the Prophet, female infanticide was just a given. You know, you had a girl baby, you just bury her alive. That was quite common. And so, of course, there were very strict rules needed to take very wild peoples. And the same in the Holy Land. At the time of Moses, if you think about it, the people just came out of Egypt. They were not particularly saintly. They were a very angry people. They'd been slaves for many, many generations. They came out of there, and they were really cutting loose. And when Moses came down from the mountain the first time, he didn't bring stone tablets. What he brought was written in the etheric. It was written in the ethers. It didn't physically exist. It was the esoteric law. And the people, in the absence of the lawgiver, just went to pieces. And it was that realization of Moses who said, we cannot give this to the people. So what happened? What actually happened was Aaron got the esoteric from Moses. Moses went back and got the law, which was then written symbolically in stone, meaning that it was of the earth, and it was the law of thou shalt not. But the first laws that were brought down were the thou shall. They weren't prohibitions. And they didn't get destroyed in anger, as we hear. They were passed on through Aaron to the esoteric schools, which then emerged. There were some people who could take the esoteric, the hidden, the subtle laws, and make great use of them. And they did. And who were they? Well, of course we take credit. They were the Sufis. The Sufis did not begin, as I said yesterday, with the Prophet Muhammad. They began with the prophets Adam and Eve. At least. Now, not from an ego perspective, but because they were called different names, of course. Where did Abraham get his training? In Egypt. Where did Jesus get his training? In Egypt. It wasn't just coincidence that they all happened to go to Egypt. That's where the esoteric school was. Where did Moses get his training? In Egypt. But that's a different weekend. Fascinating, but we can't do that. So, these subtle ways are important for us to know in learning about death. It is enough to know that there are other planes of consciousness. It is enough to know that when you leave the body here, the first awakening is in a dream state. It's the same state as our dreams. Forgive me the people who were here yesterday because I'm repeating. The only difference is you have the knowledge that you will not awaken. Now, actual death. I didn't go over this yesterday. Actual death for the uninitiated, for the unprepared. There are only two kinds of deaths. There are the death of those who have prepared for death in life and the death of those who have not. Death is the great test to which some go prepared and some go unprepared. The work of the spiritual path, among other things, is to prepare us for death. One of the work of Sufis is to teach people how to die. Why? Because when you die, you will give off, eventually, all impressions which have not been finished on the earth. Those unfinished impressions will be taken in by souls coming into the earth and will continue to exist, those impressions. Those unfinished thoughts and feelings. So, we will be creating the future by what we bring with us to our death. If we bring hate, if we bring violence, if we bring bigotry, if we bring selfishness, those impressions will eventually be discarded because the universe is compassion. And other souls coming in who have no discrimination whatsoever will take them on, and those same impressions will come back into earth. Now, they might not be lived the same way. Maybe that soul will be the very one that brings peace. Maybe that soul that's carrying the impression of war will become the peacemaker. But maybe not. Frankly, more often than not, that impression just gets relived. So, you know, in the Bible it says, the sins of the father shall be visited upon the sons. Well, unfortunately, the sins of the fathers and the mothers will be incarnated by the sons and the daughters. Not literal sons and daughters, but sons and daughters. And in some cases, literal, because blood is a very powerful transmitter. So, and we won't have time to discuss heredity here, but there are some souls that pass and have a certain impression that they will wait 5, 10, 15 generations until somebody in their bloodline comes along who is the right person, and it can be a terrible impression, by the way, and they will pass it on to that person because they know that that person has their blood. Blood is very powerful. Anybody know Hebrew or Arabic? Little? What's blood, do you know? Yeah, remember the plague? Dam. Yeah, Adam. Adam is blood. Same in Arabic. Who was the first prophet? Adam. What does it mean? It means the earth. Adam. The blood, the word for blood is the word for the earth. There's a lot that we can learn if we just look at the obvious. Anyway, so the earth is passed on from generation to generation through the earth, through the blood. And for those of you who have studied real Sufi healing, you know, I hope you know, that fear is held in the blood, in the human body, the physical body. Fear is held in the blood. And we even say it. We say, oh, that poisoned me, or my blood went cold, you know, when we're afraid. That fear is held in the blood. If you wish to relieve fear and you do Sufi practices, you need to do elemental practices that cleanse the blood. That's how you release fear. That and yawning. Which practices? Not now. No, I really mean it, not now, because I want to make sure that I tell you what to do when you die, in case anybody dies soon, and you'll be ready. Not really for that reason. I don't intuit that's going to happen, but we can share these things. It's not that you have to share things out loud either. I have worked with many people, many, many Marids and non-Marids, who've taken this teaching, who work with it silently in hospices, hospitals, or even with relatives who are dying. They never have to say anything out loud. Everything is done on the breath. Everything is done on the breath. And if you know this, if you help one person pass, you've done a great thing in this world. Nobody knows how to help people who are dying. We try and make them physically comfortable and give them drinks, you know, but that's not what they want. They want this. And if we haven't got it in life, as we get to the end of life, the need becomes apparent. But there's nobody there to fulfill it. So you'll be the real angels of death, the real angels at death. The moment of death is important, just like the moment of birth. When my children were born, the first thing that I did as the father, not the first thing my wife did, the first thing I did as the father was I whispered in each of their ears, the first real sound that they heard, a certain name of God, different for each of them, that represents a certain attribute that came to me and my wife in prayer and in preparation for receiving this child. This was our duty to them. And interestingly enough, in their way, they're each living exactly that word. Now, that's the responsibility parents have. You don't have to do that ceremony, but something to bring the spiritual right into their life immediately. They're coming from the spirit. They come into this world of matter. They're, you know, it doesn't matter at that point if they're born in a hospital or at home birth. I mean, it matters. But what matters is that the spirit is present because they're familiar with that. This is all another universe to them. But you're welcoming them. You're giving them direction, which is very helpful. When people die, if we can do, in essence, the same thing, we've done a great service. We're just reminding the soul, you're free that way. Go that way. And for Sufis, we are instructed to know that at the moment of our death, if we're conscious or unconscious, zikr on the breath is the only thing we need to know. So, and when I say Sufis, I mean it in the loosest sense of the word, because that's what Sufis really are. Sufis are life in the loosest sense. We have no tension. You know, tension is the sign of anything but a Sufi. So, what does that mean? At the moment of death, of your death, if you remember nothing else, just remember, and you'll know the moment or moments. Whatever word for you, by the way, represents zikr. You don't have to do Allah. It can be anything at all, whatever religion, wherever your heart is, that doesn't matter. But that word must be there. And if you can remember the sound who, and do that, that would be very good. I won't say best, because I'm not wise enough to say what's best. But if you can remember just who, and it doesn't have to be out loud, if you can just think it for a moment, that would be very good. Or Allah. We'll get there. First things first. My first responsibility is to the me that is present here in the form of you. You know, the spiritual path is really for people who are divinely selfish and who understand the big ego. It's really very simple. Every human being you meet is you. That's really the inner meaning, of course, of the Golden Rule, which is in every tradition. So I'm seeing all of the me before me right now. I have to make sure that we're all taken care of. Because human beings have a tendency, especially in this era, to distract ourselves with compassion. This is a time when we should forget about compassion, forget about mercy, forget about God, and just pay attention, so that we can drum into our deepest subconscious and superconscious at the moment of my death. That moment can be very disorienting. We use the body for orientation. None of us ever get into our bodies, by the way. But we use the body as a focal point. We use it wisely. The only one who gets into our body is God. This is truly the temple of God. But at the moment of death, it's very disorienting if we're unprepared because we do not have that focal point. And we're used to this physical point of reference. And it all goes. My wife does some incredible research in China on migraine. And she's the first non-Asian to be offered a PhD from one of the three great medical schools in China in migraine. And she's the first one to get a PhD, but her area is migraine. And because of this, she studies migraine in Western medicine, in Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic, homeopathy, yoga, everything, the whole, whatever she can devour. And I always joke with her, I say, you know, just so you know, there's nobody else in the world who's done what you've done in the whole world, which is true. Anyway, she was telling me, she was reading to me a description written by a Western physician who suffers from migraines. And he was describing what happens when migraines come on. And the reason she was reading it is many people, and I've heard this too, who have very strong migraines, they say they feel like they're dying when it first comes on. They think they're going to die. And then he described his symptoms. And his symptoms are, in a sense, the symptoms of death. You lose physical orientation. You don't see the way that we see here. It's like a dream. You know how you see in a dream and things merge in one into the other and you're not quite sure if you're looking this way but seeing that way or up or down? It's very disorienting, death, if you're not used to it. If you're used to it, if you know how to relax, lay back in the arms of God, if you trust at that point, everything will be all right. I don't worry, frankly, about Sufis dying, regardless what I say. You'll die quite well. But we need to relieve some of the fear in us about death so that we can then become what we need to become. So it is a disorienting process. We do want to focalize on, really focus on the divine sound, the divine name. And whatever is closest to your heart that represents the infinite, that's what you must focus on in the end. Now people say, well, can I focus on my children? And I say, no. Because really, much as you love them, that's not what's closest to your heart. And then people get mad at me and say, yes, it is. There is the hidden, which is closest to the heart of every human being. The hidden, the mystery, the one, the presence. It's wise to begin to become familiar with that. With that. If you focus on people who are closest to you, two things will happen. One is you will not leave here easily. And two, you will recreate them. I think I spoke of this yesterday, where I said people are talking about, oh, I can't wait to die and see my mother and so on. What happens is you create a world in which your mother is there by your creation. You know, when you die, it's much easier to create in the unseen world. You know how dreams are. So if your whole focus is on your mother, you will see your mother. But is it your mother? It is in form, but the creator of that mother is you. This is the part that the mystics don't usually say. And you can see why. It could confuse many people. So when people come and they say, oh, you know, I had this experience and I saw my mother, and I say, how wonderful, alhamdulillah. Praise be to God. But you're all sitting here and you need to know, you need the graduate level course, you know. You need to know that what you see there is going to be of your creation. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Some of you are followers of Inayat Khan, and his name has come up again and again. He wrote this beautiful little play called The Boogeyman. Pretty wild play, actually. And there are different scenarios in this play. And the boogeyman is a sage. And he called it the boogeyman because it begins with the sage being in a rest stop with four people. Maybe there's five people, I guess. And there's a speculator, a lady. This was written about 80 years ago. A modernist, and one loves material things and money, and one loves politics, and one loves propriety, and one is the lover, and so on. And then there's that scene, and then the scene with the different kinds of murids. The sage meets his murids, and there are, I think, 12 murids. And if you're a murid of anybody, you should read that play. Those are the 12 archetypes of murids, and it's very funny. And you'll see yourself in all 12, I hope. And then the next scene, he's accused of the murder of somebody wrongly, and he's in jail and he's healing. And then the queen of this country finds out he's innocent and releases him and wants to meet him, and they fall in love, and he stops being the sage. He takes off his simple clothing. He becomes the king with her. And they rule this country together, and it's this incredible country where it's enlightened, and they have a child, a prince, and the prince grows up and he becomes this perfected human being. And it's like, and you expect it to say, and they live happily ever after. And then at that point, the king is on the veranda with the queen and the prince. And he shows up in his old clothing, the clothing of the sage. And he says to the queen, my dear love, I must go. You're never going to see me again. And she said, but what do you need? And he said, what I need I can only find alone in the wilderness. And, you know, it's terrible, because here he is walking out on his family, and and his child. They bring the prince in, but how can you leave the prince? And he said, the prince knows enough. He'll be fine. And then he gives this line, the last line of the play, about the human being. And he said, the purpose, to tarry here a while and then move on. And this is the great instruction for death. We're not meant to be here forever. We're really not. We're meant to visit here. This is the end of this journey in this way. To tarry here for a little bit and then have the wisdom to gracefully move on. The problem arises, and it does arise, when there is confusion in the mind of the person who dies, and there is too much attachment, and they don't move on. Instead of leaving the aura of the earth, they stay. They're just too attached. And it's very sad. They cannot enjoy life physically anymore, obviously. They can only live through us. And who do they live through? They live through many people who have weakened natures for whatever reason. Much of what we call insanity is really obsession. And it is weakened people who become hosts for minds that are not healthy, bless you, not moving in the right direction. And much of these seemingly violent killings and things that we don't even need to hear about, we all know what I'm talking about, and much psychological and physical abuse that is that occurs towards innocent children and especially towards women, it is from souls that are not able to experience physically anymore, spirits, and they create more and more violence because that's easier to experience that vibration, more and more dark events, because it's easier to experience the energy from darkness. Now, if we, conscious human beings, were creating in meditation, in prayer, and most importantly, in our interaction in daily life, if we were creating lighter worlds individually, then it would be easier for them to experience that lightness rather than darkness, and they would leave. They would naturally go on their way. But that's not the case, and so we are having more and more seemingly inexplicable acts of insanity. I don't know what else to call it. You hear about the things today, and it is because, partly, I should say, because of the tremendous confusion that exists on the earth today, and that is not preparing souls for death.